Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Prospective Spouse Checklist teleclass. My name is Dr. Ali Benazir, and you probably heard about this call through the Dial of Dating. I sent you an email, or through the Harvard Club of Southern California. Either way, welcome to the call. I'm really glad you could make it because we have a very special treat for you today. I think the best information you can get regarding running your life is from other people who have lived a good one, people who've done it well. So I'm very pleased to introduce to you tonight someone who brings a wealth of both clinical experience and also personal experience that can inform our decisions when it comes to long-term relationships. So my friend and colleague Isabel Fox, whom I have known for about 6-7 years now, we've been on the board of the Harvard Club of Southern California for a while. She has been a marriage and family therapist for over 30 years and has seen thousands upon thousands of cases. She's been doing clinical practice since 1962, and individual and group psychotherapy, specializing in developmental issues of children, families, adults, and also relationship counseling. She's had many publications, including a particularly a somewhat controversial one a little while back, which got her some interesting attention in press. And so Isabel has not been afraid to basically tell you like it is. And that's exactly why I really like her new book, The Prospective Spouse Checklist, which came out about, a month ago, Isabel, was it? Fantastic. Yeah. And so I thought that, you know, month of February with Valentine's Day and everything is a great time to, you know, really think about either the relationship you're in or the one you would like to be in. And that's why we have today with us Dr. Isabel Fox. And also as a special treat, her co-author and husband of 64 years, Robert Fox. So welcome, Isabel and Robert.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. So let me give you a little intro about this Prospective Spouse Checklist and why I like it a lot. First of all, it's based on common sense. I mean, you read it and it's just like, oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, in common sense these days is not a terribly common commodity. So that, I think, makes it particularly useful just on that basis. The second thing I like about it is that it's based on a lot of case studies. So Isabel has seen hundreds upon hundreds of patients, lots of couples, and has had the luxury of time to see how various relationships unfold, and then you get that story in a matter of a couple of paragraphs, so you're like, oh, I guess that thing doesn't really work that well. And so those things alone, you know, make the book probably the best $14.95 you've ever spent. But on top of that, you know, it's just really straightforward. You got this list, and you go through it, and all this experience gathered from hundreds of different lives, and also the life of Isabel herself, who's been married for 64 years. All this comes to you in a matter of, you know, just a couple of hours that you spend with this, and you look through a checklist, and guess what? You have just ensured a much better chance of thriving for your relationship. So, Isabel, thank you so much for coming. And my first question for you is, what motivated you to write this book?
Well, I've been in practice, as you mentioned, a long time, and I saw the devastating effect divorce had on both the adults involved and certainly on the children. And my husband, who was also involved with litigation and marital disputes and so on, we felt that perhaps if people really made some better choices before they got married and took some time to really get to know one another, that they would have a better chance of surviving a good marriage and creating a good marriage.
No, that's great. And again, the case studies, I mean, they're just so illustrative. I read these, I'm like, oh my God. And you can just kind of see where something is heading. But the value of wisdom like yours and books like yours is that, you know, when people are in those case studies themselves, they can't see it. So it's really useful to take that step back, look at the book, and from there you're like, oh, I'm kind of doing something similar, so perhaps I should reconsider. And
I'd like to mention, Ollie, that it's sad that this is one of the most important of all life decisions, and yet none of us in grade school, high school, college, graduate school, or anyplace else get any instruction or ideas how do you go about best selecting a spouse.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to emphasize about this checklist, for those of you who have not yet read the book, is that it's not like a checklist of pickiness. It's like, well, you know, he has to go on to so-and-so school. She has to have this color hair, you know, this height. This is just due diligence. This is like, okay, I am getting into a long-term business proposal with somebody, right? And therefore, I should check out what their credit is like, you know, what their previous businesses, how they worked out. I mean, you do the same kind of due diligence for that. And yet when it comes to this, people are like, well, I'm in love, therefore this must be right. And you know, and you have the 50% divorce rate in this country, 7.5 year length of average length of marriage. And I just think, you know, people deserve a better chance than a coin flip for success of their long-term relationships.
We just felt the present system, which is mainly based on emotional, I love you, you love me, let's get married, it isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel there's a better system, and we discuss it in our book, and that was designed to help people make a better choice.
It what it does is give some structure in the courting process and give a way of looking at some of the very important aspects of marriage. I mean, I think it's really, we have to, in finding a person, we really have to find two important things, two requirements for a long-term relationship.
Two requirements. Okay, listen up, kids. Two requirements.
Two requirements. The first is really, does this person have the ability to sustain and commit to a long-term relationship?
The ability to sustain and commit, okay.
And the second is this person a good match to me? Do we, are there things that are similar? Are there things that we have in common? Are there attributes that I really enjoy in that person? So the two requirements are, is this person a good match? And does this person have the capacity to commit and to sustain that relationship?
Good match and willing to commit. And then from there, we get a much longer list of things. And you know, there are 35 items there, and no one person's expected to get get an A+ on all 35. But you do have the 10 red flag items. I'm sorry, yes?
The other thing that's important is not only do you marry someone who you're attracted to,
mm-hmm.
but there are four very specific roles that each person has to play. Beside being a lover and a sex partner, which is certainly that which we attract, you know, you're attracted to that person because of your sexual attraction to them. But then that person has to be a very good friend and companion and advisor, as well as a business partner, because lots of money comes and goes in this institution. And in the end, a person has to be a parent. Not only if there are children involved, you have to act as a parent, but in times of stress and difficulty, we tend to need to parent each other.
In other words, let me, Bob chiming in here, the four roles are lover, friend, parent, and business partner. And you need all those in both husband and wife.
Lover, parent, friend, and business partner, and truer words have not been spoken today. And, you know, most people who get married, they're getting married for the first time, so they kind of get into it thinking, oh, love, we have that, therefore everything else will work out. But those four things, I mean, you know, you are going to be sharing finances, so business partner. You will be hopefully having kids, so, you know, good parents. So all these things come into play. Let's dive into the meat of the matter. By the way, those of you who are joining us right now, welcome to the call. We have here Dr. Isabel Fox and Robert Fox, the couple who wrote the Prospective Spouse Checklist. So, and right now we're about to get into a little bit of what that checklist entails. So, Isabel, tell us a little bit about the red flags, the top 10.
Okay, well, let me just say, we divided the checklist up into four different sections.
Mm-hmm.
The first is just sort of basic information like is the person single or similar in
new entry tone off
differences, education differences, and so on. So there's those sort of simple information that you can get pretty easily in a first and second date. But the second part of the checklist has to do with family history, how that person was treated and loved in the early years. Did the parents of the potential spouse remain married? Were they good relationships with the parents or grandparents, and so on? And then there's the personality traits. You know, is the person kind or generous or cheerful? And that's sort of something that really takes a while to find out whether the person is flexible or neat or. And then there's the mutual elements of companionship. Do you enjoy time together? Is there sexual attraction? Do you agree on major goals and so on? And then the last area is other problems involving addiction or physical or mental health problems and so on. So the checklist is divided in those four sections.
Four sections.
Yeah. Four or five sections.
Now, of course, those four or five sections occupy or take 35 items. In other words, there are 35 items under these various sections, five or six under one, et cetera, et cetera. But with the basic purpose of the checklist is to determine if the person you're hoping to marry is going to be a successful lover, friend, parent, and business partner, and whether the person you select can fulfill those two requirements Isabel mentioned, that is being a good match and having the capacity to sustain a long-term relationship. So that's what the checklist is supposed to help you determine.
Right. And it's interesting because the checklist, if you just read it quickly.
Fulfill those two requirements.
Sorry to interrupt there. Right. It's interesting because when you look at the checklist and, you know, just take a cursory glance, initially you're like, well, that's pretty obvious. But, you know, for example, one of the items is wants to have children, right? Agreement on major goals, having a family, religious affiliation, childcare, right? And, you know, right. I'm always shocked and amazed when people get into a relationship, you know, they fall in love, they get married, they move in together, a year into it, one person wants kids and the other one doesn't. And it's like, what, you didn't discuss this? I mean, it's kind of a major thing. So let's go into some of these items individually, shall we? Which would you like to tackle first?
One thing we mentioned, we have some starred items. We have 10 starred items,
mm-hmm.
called red flag items, which are pretty serious if they're no's. If you check a no on it.
Yeah. Yeah, those are, I call them the deal breakers or red flags. I like the first one. Number one is single, and that's always interesting how people don't do their homework. Talk to us a little bit about that, since it seems really obvious,
so,
but really it's
amazing
not.
Amazing how many people are dating someone who's already married.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas that person may say they're going to get divorced, it may be something that's quite far in the future. So I think it's really important if that person is still married to take a second look at the situation.
Well, let's take a look at what the example we give. There's a person dating someone who was married, and the person, so the gal asked the boy, well, when are you going to get divorced? So the girl says, well, we're going to get divorced, but we haven't worked out the custody issues for our children. But we hope it'll be done soon. So, you know, how long is it going to take? They may get back together. They may never get divorced.
Right. So the message here is separated is not the same thing as single.
Right.
Right. Right. So, and who knows what could happen, and they might get back together. And this has happened to people before. I mean, I've had close friends who were dating somebody, and, you know, for sure they were separated. The woman was separated from the husband. And next thing you know, the woman is pregnant, and it's not his kid, and it's the husband's kid. So he's like, what's going on here? So...
Right.
So, right. Okay. Now, this one I think is particularly important because it's something that most people gloss over, and yet it is such a determinant of people's behavior, especially in the context of an intimate relationship. And that is item number 9, well-treated, loved, and nurtured in early years. Isabel, tell us about that.
Yes, that is so profound and so important, because how we have been treated as children, how we've been nurtured and loved, really is a great predictor of how we will respond to a spouse, a marriage partner.
And also the children that they have together.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the if there is a no, when there has been abuse or abandonment or mistreatment or neglect, there's so much anger left over from those early experiences that get projected onto the new relationship, that you really have to think carefully when you are dating someone who's had a very stormy early childhood.
That's definitely a powerful thing to consider. Now, my question to you is a practical one. So how do you find out about that? And let's say you get a negative. You're like, uh-oh, bad history, right? What do you do? Do you bow out? How do you do that gracefully? Do you try to fix it? What do you propose? What have you seen in your case studies?
Well, I think it's important to at least discuss the early childhood. And sometimes, you know, in the dating, you can begin to say, well, you know, what do you remember about your childhood? You know, were your parents strict? How were you disciplined? Or what parent is your favorite? Or, you know, I think very casually in the dating process, you begin to get a picture of what a person's early childhood was like.
Mm-hmm.
I think if a person can survive a negative early childhood, if they have a later reparative relationship,
mm-hmm.
if they said, you know, I had a miserable experience with my mother, she was mean and she was never there, and I felt neglected, but I did have a grandmother who in my later school age years was very loving, and I always felt protected by her, and I always felt that she was there for me. And so in some situations, having that early childhood experience but then having a reparative other experience can really modify the negative.
I think that's really important, because, you know, there's a fair amount of studies done on the effect of childhood attachment, secure attachment, non-secure attachment, and also the fact that some people rebound and become more functional, and some people basically become less functional as a result of, you know, childhood trauma. So, you know, how do you assess whether somebody, I mean, how about this, just to make it very straightforward, do you think
one thing that's important to make this decision is having a long engagement and courtship.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, no quick whirlwind romance. After you have dated and gone with a person and perhaps lived together, if they do that, you get a pretty good idea of how you're going to be treated in the marriage. And if a person, for example, is unable to control anger, there's early childhood, et cetera, you find that out with a long engagement.
But I think the thing about early childhood experiences, it really depends when the trauma took place.
When, okay.
If the trauma and the abuse and the neglect took place in the first 3 years, the prognosis is much more serious than if the neglect and the negative experience occurred, say, when the child was 5 or 7 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's those first 3 years that are so basic.
First 3 years trump all else. Okay. And
the pre-verbal years, when if a child was well nurtured and loved and responsibly cared for, those first 2-3 years are so basic, so that a child who's had that beginning security can weather a lot of negatives later on.
Absolutely. Okay, so this can potentially be by itself a deal breaker, but potentially it can be overcome, which brings us to item number 12, good relationships with parents, siblings, and grandparents. And anecdotally, you know, from people that I know, from my readers and from myself, I've noticed that, you know, especially the relationship with parents tends to get reflected into the intimate relationship, you know, and gets projected onto the partner. Sometimes, you know, the mother gets projected onto the female partner and the father onto the male partner. So tell us about item 12.
So if a girl has had a loving relationship with her father, it bodes well for the marriage. But if she was abused or neglected, and especially if that was reinforced by a negative relationship with a brother, I have a case here where this young woman was very frightened by her father's anger and his treatment of her, and she was bullied by her older brother. And so in the marriage, in the relationship, if the husband at least raised his voice a little bit or showed any kind of irritation, she was thrown into a panic.
Right. Now, my question about this is specific. Good relationship with parents, siblings, and grandparents. Children of divorce. So that's got to have some kind of effect. So would you say there's like a break point, like an age before and after, that if the divorce happens after a certain age, they tend to do okay or better than if it happens before a certain age?
Yes, I think so. I think it's tough on children when they're in their preschool years, first through five. I think it's very hard on children when parents are divorced and they really have a sense of abandonment and they're very anxious about who will really take care of them. And then when there's divorce in the teenage years, of course, children at that age are so self-centered anyway, and they just can't bear to deal with the issues around their parents. So that tends to be a stressful time for them. And many of these people are very gun-shy when it comes to making a commitment later on. We just wrote a blog, actually, on the Huffington Post about why the marriage rate has dropped. And the marriage rate has dropped partially in relation to the high divorce rate of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where the children of divorce now are dating age, and they are pretty gun-shy. So they're a little afraid to make that commitment, to make that that jump into a committed relationship, because they've experienced so much turmoil and so much sadness and anger and general aggravation.
Right. Now, again, my question is, do you think this is an absolute deal breaker? Can this be overcome? And if so, how?
Well, I think any negative experience can be helped through another supportive relationship, another therapeutic relationship. So, I mean, people are responsive to positive relationships wherever they are. So, I think therapy can help. Having a good friend that's perhaps gone through a similar experience, being in a group where there's a supportive environment, can all help.
Again, I'd like to mention that a long engagement was very important to observe just this type of thing. How do we get along after 5 or 6 months? Again, it underscores the danger of getting married, making a decision on marriage quickly. Take your time.
Take your time. That seems to be a recurring theme. And when something comes up over and over, it may be a useful thing to pay attention to and perhaps implement.
Another real deal breaker is the ability to control anger. If there's a no on that, we know that it seems to be one of the largest factors in divorce. the inability to modify their angry responses.
This is number 23 on the list.
What?
Number 23 on the list.
Right. Yeah, number 23.
That's right.
So either verbal abuse or physical abuse seems to be a real deal breaker. And that, of course, also comes from early childhood experiences where children were perhaps harshly treated, traumatically punished, and so on.
Right. And you had a very interesting case study in the book about Adani and Althea. Could you share that with us? It was Adani and Althea were physical therapists.
Yes, and they really got along pretty well, except for the fact that he just seemed to have a short fuse. And if the food came out cold in the restaurant, he would throw the plate down. He would overreact in a traffic jam, and it was pretty frightening for her. And of course, I think the deal breaker came when he was angry with her and he pushed her. Yeah.
Ooh. And, okay.
That was in the dating process. So I think she took a very careful look, even though they were very compatible, had a lot in common, and they seemed to enjoy each other.
And what was the upshot of that?
Well, the upshot was is that she decided to leave the relationship.
And good for her. And I want to emphasize both to the men and women on the call that, you know, if you're a nice, healthy person and, you know, kind, generous, all these things, you've had a good upbringing, then really you do have a lot of choices. The world's a very, very big place. And if somebody is, like, pointlessly mean to you, is angry to you, or inflicts any kind of physical violence upon you, that is just, you know, absolute red flag. That is deal breaker right there. And you deserve better. So just walk. And, you know, you may think, oh, but I love him. But that kind of behavior is not loving.
People often feel that marriage will cure the person, that marriage will take care of it because we love each other so much or we're so good together and bad. But what happens is that not only doesn't marriage cure it, but often the other stresses in marriage seem to make things worse.
People forget that marriage actually, yes, is a big stressor. You get a whole bunch of new stuff you have to worry about.
I think one of the problems when you see a no, when you see a red flag, one of the issues involved is you probably already have a set of an attachment to that person.
Right.
And to break off that attachment is painful. And sometimes people feel it's better to survive the negative that we know than go back into the dating world that we don't know.
Hmm.
So attachments are formed in the very early parts of a relationship, which make it often hard for our logical brains to say, hey, this isn't really healthy. This isn't really good. And so we tend to, because we're afraid of being separated, of being alone, of being needing to date again, we tend to sustain relationships that aren't really that healthy.
Well, that's why we stress in one of our chapters the necessity of building and keeping a pool of prospective spouses in the background so that if you feel that the person you're dating is not right for you, you feel more comfortable in saying goodbye because you've built a pool or you have a pool of other possible dates.
And that is brilliant. I call in the book for women, I call it the three-man plan. And in the book for men, you know, it's the multi-woman plan. Either way, the point is the world is your supermarket, so, you know, you're not starving. And if the meal, you know, doesn't suit you, then you should ask for something else from the universe to give you.
And we do have a chapter that tells how to do that. In other words, how to search and how to look and how to build a pool. That's mm-hmm. covered in the book elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And women can be much more proactive these days in terms of finding more people for their pool with the internet and with other dating services.
Yes, we give a lot of ideas on how to use the internet sitting in your pajamas in the evening, a young lady can go through 5 or 10 guys right on the computer and find somebody who looks interested.
There are definitely options out there. Now, the question I have is the actual practical aspect. So you have someone, and you're starting to have feelings for that person, and red flag comes up. So what do you do? Because, you know, you're already caught up in your cognitive biases, you're already caught up in, you know, all these juices running through your body, oxytocin, phenylethylamine, this, that, the other. What do you do? Do you ask a friend to give you a second opinion? Do you ask for an intervention? How are you able to assess the situation with a clear head and make the right decision, considering that we are fallible decision makers?
Well, let's take – that's a very good question. Let's take number 26, enjoy time together.
Uh-huh,
now,
okay.
Let's say the couple is getting sex – the sex, that is great. However, when they go – let's say they're going on a trip. They go on a trip together and they go to have dinner. Let's say they go to Las Vegas or Atlantic City, depending on what part of the country it is. They find they have nothing to talk about. They do not seem to have anything to say to each other. There are long periods of silence. And it turns out that while the sexual relationship is very good, they are not really friends and companions. They don't seem to have interests together. They don't seem to enjoy talking together. When they go away, they want to go away with somebody else so they'll have something to talk about. Now, this is dangerous, and it indicates that one of the four roles, friend, companion, advisor, may not be there. And that is a red flag item. And this is precisely what you probably are talking about. You may be thinking of that. This is a red flag item. What do you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
When they're really not good friends, companions, they're only good in bed together.
Right. And I think the usefulness of the checklist is that you have like this panel, this dashboard in front of you. And if you actually go through it and go check, check, X, X, you know, put it in various places, then you actually see what's going on. And perhaps once, you know, maybe just the childhood, the background of, you know, having a rough childhood, you're thinking, well, okay, that's not that big a deal. Maybe you don't talk together that well. Maybe that's not that big a deal. Maybe, you know, there's, you know, incompatibilities when it comes to how you run your finances. But then when you see there's a whole bunch of them, maybe that's the wake-up call. I mean, have you found
that's
any of your
right.
patients, like,
that's right.
operating that way?
I think it's really important to find out in the dating process whether there are any addictions to alcohol, drugs, or gambling. Because when people are addicted, they're really married to their addiction.
Mm.
And they're really not able to focus on sustain a relationship. So to find out about these, I mean, it's not something you see on a first date. And it's often not something you see on a date where you just go to have dinner and to a movie. You really have to have a wide spectrum of activities. Go camping together, go mountain climbing together, go bike riding. So do things in which, I mean, go to the beach, where you really begin to peel the onion, where you begin to see a more complicated side of a person.
Right. And also, you know, there is some flexibility in this too, in that if you have someone who's open to new experiences, then, for example, this friend of mine, he was a super athlete and an avid rock climber, and his future wife said, sure, I'd like to learn that. And then she became an avid rock climber. So mm-hmm. if you're willing to share, if the other person's open. So I think that idea of
like item 20 is flexibility. So
flexibility.
She didn't have that as a part of her past experience, but she was flexible enough to throw herself into the whole process of rock climbing.
And this also works into the friend, companion, advisor. If you do things together and have experiences together, that's what companionship and friendship is all about. And a spouse is should be a friend and companion.
Now, you touched upon item 33, no addiction to smoking, alcohol, drugs, or gambling. Can you offer a case study of something that was so lined up, that was so headed for success, but then just one of these derailed it?
Yes, well, our second chapter in the book is a case study about Gary and Joan, who are both graduate students in an MBA program, and they're very compatible. They're very, very good-looking couple, and they get along well, and they seem to have a good future ahead. And they go to Las Vegas, and they have a romantic interlude there. And there is some drinking and some gambling. And he asks her in that time, because they seem so compatible, that they should get married. And so with feeling very, very excited by the opportunity to get married, they plan a wedding and they go off on a honeymoon.
It's all very fast.
It's all very fast, kind of within 6 to 8 weeks.
Well, what she doesn't realize is that this fellow doesn't just do it in Las Vegas. He drinks regularly, and he's really addicted.
No mind.
What happens when they come back from their honeymoon, they had ordered their furniture to come into their new apartment, and the refrigerator is missing. And not only is the refrigerator missing, but so is their bank account.
Oh, my.
He's used the money that was their wedding present money to pay his gambling debt and so on. So we shortened the story, but what it amounts to is that she really didn't get to know the extent of what she sort of saw in the quick trip to Las Vegas. But she was so overwhelmed with his good looks and his charm and his potential as an MBA graduate that she overlooked it, and she enjoyed the whole aspect of the marriage itself.
In other words, there was no long engagement. She didn't really look. She didn't go over the items, and disaster.
However, in chapter 4, she has the checklist, and so there's a little different outcome.
You know, we went through the whole thing, tell the story, what she should have done. And the second way we handle the relationship is Joan uses her head, and this time when he proposes, she says, not so fast, you've got some problems we have to work on.
Oh, wow. All right.
They might actually get married, but he has to work on controlling the gambling and the alcoholism before she'll marry him.
Right. And if I may chime in, from personal experience and anecdotal evidence, the whole addictive personality thing is very difficult to overcome. In fact, I would say it's impossible to overcome. It's things that are inherent to somebody's neurology you just can't fix. And for the guys and the ladies out there, go for prefab. Go for somebody who's already okay. Don't go for a fixer-upper. Go for something that's, you know, already in pretty good shape. And the addiction thing is really hard to overcome.
Good advice.
Yeah, but again, we see that the whole longer courtship, that would have cured the issue.
Yeah, she would have found out.
She would have found out. And again, you know, it's really hard when you're so attached to someone. You think, oh my God, it's going so well. It's been so long since I found somebody that I was so attracted to. My God, you know, we have so much fun together. And then you have to kind of willfully put a stop to it. But think about it. Better 6 months than 60 years. Better 6 months than six
True.
Years.
And without, before children come along.
Before children come along and things get a lot more complicated. So, you know, a couple of weeks of moping versus, you know, 20 years of hell, I'm going to take the moping every time. All right, good. So for those of you who joined us on the call later, we've already gone through a bunch of the big items on the list, actually most of the red flag items. Number one, we want the person to be single as opposed to, say, just separated or still married. Item 9 is well-treated, loved, and nurtured in early years. Item 12 is good relationships with parents, siblings, and grandparents. 23 is able to control anger. 26 is enjoy time together. And we also went through 33, no addiction to smoking, alcohol, drugs, or gambling. And while we're on the seemingly obvious, why don't we talk about sexual attraction? That's item 27. So
that, I think that's so important because often people...
That's number 27.
People do need to feel sexually attracted. And I think we do need to not only feel it in the courtship process, but couples need to create an environment where sexual attractiveness and availability really continues throughout the marriage process. Because often women especially will feel that they can be sexual while they're dating or in the first years of marriage, but then they often, their sexual interests decline, and they often, it often becomes, I think, a negative.
Isabel, if we were to put this in very brass tacks terms, what would you tell the woman to do then?
To make sure that both of them have some sexual satisfaction during the entire marriage.
In other words, put out early and often.
Yes.
If I may put it crudely, yes.
At least if you're tired and don't feel like it, say, well, let's do it.
Not
Saturday afternoon.
No, there's not too many headaches.
Right. Okay. Not too many headaches is the key to a more successful long-term relationship. And another thing about the sexual attraction part.
And I don't think you should get married if you're not sexually attracted, just because the person looks good, or a person seems to have a good future, or a person may be a good parent. But if there's no sexual attraction in the beginning, I don't think that's a positive.
Right.
Sex is only one of the 35 items. It's very difficult to have a decent marriage without continuing sexual attraction.
Yeah. Even amongst the 10 red flags, I think there's the super red flags, and that's definitely one of them. That, in the anger one. And, if you don't have a sexual attraction, that's kind of the base, the foundation of the whole connection, and it's very difficult to overcome. And some people go with their own mental checklist and he's so perfect in every other way except for this, but everything else is great, so this will also be okay. And I don't think it really works out that way. What have you found in your clinical experience, Isabel?
Well, I agree, and I think that there's a lot of anger built up when there's not a good sexual relationship.
Right, and then you have problems later on, like infidelity, which you weren't really planning on, but you've in fact kind of precipitated.
Exactly. And there's a lot of infidelity in the postpartum period, where men think the woman is delivered back to her own pre-pregnancy state, and instead she's focused on a baby, and she's not physically as interested, and men feel very abandoned.
Well, I'm glad that you're saying it and not me, because as a guy saying you should do this, it just doesn't sound right. But yes, apparently that is the message, and guys too. Guys need to be taking care of their woman as well.
That's right. Both have an obligation to see to it that sex life continues, that it is regular, and that particularly with men, the woman's job is to make sure that he has sufficient sex, because men are more programmed sexually than women for all kinds of reasons, and that has to be recognized and dealt with.
And I believe in even the Hebrew Bible, it's a duty of the man to satisfy his wife. It's a mitzvah.
Man has to learn how to satisfy his wife, and she has to make sure he is satisfied. In other words, it is mutual.
Absolutely.
Right. You know, in the book, we have a nurturing checklist, where people need to look at how a person reacts as a nurturing spouse. And have I said something positive and complimentary during the day? Have I helped if that other person may need a little help? Or have I listened when there seems to be some problem? There are many things that we should do daily to nurture each other. And certainly to understand a person's sexual needs is part of that.
Absolutely. All right, I think we've made that one pretty clear. And I want to touch upon maybe one more list item. I think something that the audience is very interested in, however, is the fact that you and Robert have been happily married for 64 years, and that's a pretty good stretch. So if you were to share some of your own personal secrets for making things work, Because, you know, marriage is always work. It's not some preordained thing. You know, people think, oh yeah, they were meant for each other, but no, it is a daily practice. So what have you guys done to make this work for this long?
Well, we met when I was a junior at Radcliffe, and he was
all of 19 years old, by the way.
And he was an ensign who had just graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and was in the Navy. And we met because his cousin was in my dorm, and within 10 minutes of our walking to have a beer, he asked me if I had read Ideal Marriage by Vandeveld, which was the official sex book of the time, of the 40s.
Maybe I moved too fast.
I thought that was odd, but it turns out he was interesting. And we had an interesting time together. He said he had a little list about, isn't that true?
Yes, actually, at the age of 21, I did have a list in my mind. Don't ask me how or why, but I thought of what I wanted in a wife. And basically, it was a very mini edition of the list that's in our book 64 years later.
In other words, this list has been tested.
A lot of luck involved. We had three healthy children. We had an interesting professional life, each of us.
We follow the checklist the thing we do each day. We ask each other.
The nurturing checklist.
I say, did anybody say how pretty you look today?
but I think that we both came from families where we really felt there was a lot of affection. The families were stable, I think we felt wanted, and I think that was a good prognosis for being good spouses. And we do argue well together.
Tell us about arguing well.
We argued a lot when we wrote this book together, and we've survived that.
What do you mean by arguing well?
Good sex life, that's important. And that number 27, you can't run it down. It's all important.
Well, you said something very interesting that I think people don't think about as often. What do you mean by arguing well?
Well, you know, we disagree on things, but we don't argue personally.
Ah.
We argue about things, but not about each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's helpful.
Yeah, and John Gottman talks about that. You know, the four horsemen. You know, contempt, criticism, stonewalling, and the fourth one, which I always forget. But you know, that's the style of argument. You know, you don't have the harsh startup. You don't make it ad hominem. It's about whatever it is it's about. It's not about you.
And
it's not about me.
And a simple rule is no name calling.
No name calling. It's very important.
No name calling. Just discuss the issue.
There you go. So you guys listening, this is real wisdom here. This is 64 years of time-tested marriage.
Well, I do have it's not exactly a poem. It's sort of a free verse of what we need from our spouses. Would you like to hear it? It's about this.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Okay, here goes. We need the warmth of a snuggle and a caress. We need to hear words of affection and encouragement. We need to feel protected and safe. We need to share worries, disappointments, and angers. We need to trust. We need occasionally to be fed, pampered, and indulged. We need erotic pleasures as our bodies merge. We need the stimulation of ideas and goals. We need to share in the joys and tribulations of parenthood. We need to join in laughter, celebration, and tears. We need support in times of stress, separation, and loss. And in the end, we need to be loved, cherished, and nurtured by someone who is there. That's it.
Excellent. Excellent. And And before we go to the Q&A, I just want to make sure people have the 10, 11 red flag items. So we gave you the first seven or so. Item 27 was sexual attraction. Number 28 is agreement on moral, ethical, and political issues, not to be underestimated. Item 29 is agreement on major goals, having a family, religious affiliation, and childcare. We did talk about 33, which is no addiction to smoking, alcohol, drugs, or gambling. And item 34 is no major physical, mental, or emotional health problems. And I want you to really think about this book as a reference, okay? So this is like your dictionary. This is like, I don't know, physician's desk reference, whatever it is. But it's an essential part of your library because you're going to go back to this over and over again with every relationship that you have. And also with the relationships of your friends. You can take a look at that list. And if you think somebody's not right for your best buddy, you're like, yo, look at this. Okay, this is why. And that way, you know, it sounds a little more authoritative. And it's all just laid out in a very simple, straightforward, easy to digest fashion that makes all kinds of sense. So thank you so much, Robert and Isabel, for joining us today. And would you be willing to take some questions from the audience, from our listeners?
Yeah, we'd be glad to.
Sure, let's do it.
Outstanding. Okay, so I believe the way this works is you press 8* on your phone, and when you do that, your little hand raising thing goes up here. So let's try that here.
Press 8 on our phone?
No. For the audience. So if you want to actually put in a question, you go like this. And let's see if that worked. Or maybe it's 5*. Okay, that works. It's 5*. So you put in 5*, and that way I know that you are asking a question. So there we go. We have area code 818 with a question. So let us unmute you here. And hello there. Who am I speaking to?
Hi there.
Hi.
This is Diane.
Diane, welcome.
Hi. I have a question. It's been raised as red flags about addictions and mental issues, but there are a lot of people out there that suffer from depression or bipolar that are being medicated, or people that have dealt with their addictions that are, let's say, in AA. I want to know we shouldn't totally disqualify people with issues if they're dealing with them, correct?
That's true. If they seem to be working on it and acknowledge that there's a problem, and feel that there is enough support to help them through the hard times, I think it's something to be looked at, but looked at carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And as Ali said, addictions are really difficult to help.
Right, and it is possible for somebody to go dry, you know, for the rest of their lives. That has happened, but there are actual hard numbers associated with these issues. So what percentage of alcoholics are able to go dry for the rest of their lives? And, you know, anecdotally, Isabel, what would you say that number is for the people you've seen? Somebody who has an addiction?
Not too many. I don't have the statistics at hand.
Mm-hmm. But you know, just ballpark.
Yeah.
Ballpark small. So I wouldn't be inclined to say 3 out of 4 don't. So the point is, this is not all, and this is not about, you know, you being mean or nice or overly strict. It's about, you know, just looking at the facts and saying, okay, do I deserve a 75% chance of happiness or a 25% chance of happiness? And if you're dealing with an addict who is an A and is taking care of it, then you're dealing with a 25% chance of a happy long-term relationship because there's a 75% relapse rate. So I don't know if that's exactly the number, but the numbers are out there. And relapse rates tend to be very high for this kind of thing. Recidivism is crazy. So what you want to do is to decide, you know, what's 25%? 25% is the probability of taking a coin and having it come up heads twice in a row. So do you deserve that or better? So that's kind of the way you think about it. Does that make sense?
Okay. It does. I have many friends who are in AA and have stayed sober over decades. So
right.
I'm surprised here that the relapse rate is that high.
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly what it is. I'm just throwing numbers out here, but I'm guessing that in general the relapse rate for alcoholism is very high. And AA is tough. I mean, how easy is it to go back to this meeting, you know, week after week after week, consistently and keeping yourself off of this one thing that you find so incredibly attractive, right? So I don't know. I haven't been there. I'm not that person, but I'm guessing it's challenging. It's challenging. So
if you do decide to continue a relationship with someone who is in AA, at least you will have you're doing it with your eyes open. And so that's important. At least you feel it's a trade-off. You know, I'm taking a chance with this person, but at least I know what I'm, a little bit of what I'm getting into.
I also, this is Bob speaking, I also think that you have to keep in mind the fact that until there are children, you're not really married solid. In other words, if you married someone like that and it doesn't work out, hold off getting, becoming pregnant or having a child until you're sure it's right. Because divorce is quite simple, legally, financially, and emotionally, until children arrive. Once children arrive, it's a bad option.
That's excellent advice. And just, you know, again, the purpose of the book is to go into this kind of thing with your eyes open. So you are informed, you've done your due diligence. Thank you so much, Diane. Anything else? Is that it?
Thank you, Diane. No, thank you for taking the call. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. All right, we have area code 310. How you doing?
Hello?
Hello, you are on.
Oh, okay. Hi, this is Eric, and great talk. Thank you both. And what is your take? I mean, you mentioned a long engagement. What is your take on living together before you get married?
Well, I think that it's a good idea to do that if you are planning to get married. But if you're just living together and hoping to, you know, keep up a pool of potential other people and just live together because it's financially desirable, I don't think it's a good idea. But I think if you're planning to, if this looks like a good prospect, it's a good idea to perhaps live together. I know all my children seem to have spent some time living together before they actually got married.
But the key concept is you don't move in and live with someone together in the same place unless you've already made at least a tentative decision to marry. You don't want to enter into it casually just to save money. Two can live more cheaply than one, because once you live with someone, you're out of circulation. No one wants to date a man or a woman who's living with someone else.
It's true. And it used to be, I mean, the stats that were out there was that living together reduces the probability of a successful marriage. But I think that's skewed because people go into it casually. And so it looks like the fewer people who are cohabitating get married and have a successful marriage. So what they found out, the new data, is that if they go into it with the intention to marry, the people who actually have some time cohabiting together tend to do better in the long run.
That's correct. That's right.
So, excellent. Anything else?
That's all I have.
Thank you. Excellent. All right. We have at least one other question. If you have questions, press 5-star, and this will make your hand raise electronically here. Then I know it is you, and then I can unmute you. So, let's see. And... all right, area code 858. Welcome. What is your question?
Hi, this is Jacqueline, and I have a couple of questions. One is on the no children. Does that apply only for young children? What if the children from the previous marriage are grown?
Well, I think that in some ways that can be a positive, and some ways it's a negative. It depends. Can you explain a little bit what the situation is?
Oh, yeah. We both have had previous marriages. His child from his previous marriage is 19 and away at college. So he's not a, you know, young child that he's caring for on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it seems to me then it's really almost like you're not involved with child care. It's a lot of the issues aren't
right. That's my question. If there's no real child care involved, is that really
right? Then it really isn't an issue in terms of how you two relate to one another. You know, I think what happens when there are children involved is we don't fall in love with the children as we do with the other, you know, the person we're dating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this can work out very well. Again, the idea is to have a good long engagement and see how it goes. I mean, there's going to be some contact with the child or children, but is there only one child involved? Is that it?
Yeah.
Well, this is the perfect example of why a long engagement is important.
But
you all know after 5 or 6 months of dating, and maybe you'll be able to meet the child, it may work out very well. You just have to live in...
19 is very different than 9 or 5
right.
or
exactly.
14. So 19, they're kind of over the hump.
Right. And there are 35 items on the checklist. So, you know, if you try to make somebody get through all of them, nobody's going to pass through. So there's a little bit of flexibility here. Just know what the absolute deal breakers are in general and for you. And go into it with, you know, with information.
Yes, we have a whole chapter on remarriage, on second marriages, and in both cases there are children involved, some with young children and some with older children, where the children are no issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
With the older children in college and in their 20s.
Okay. I also had a question about the item of whether the person's parents were divorced. I'm wondering whether just the absence of divorce is good enough, or does it actually have to be a good marriage? And I ask this because I am a child of divorce, but my mother remarried shortly after the divorce, and I grew up in a very loving home with my stepfather, who basically was, for all intents and purposes, my father, and they've had a wonderful marriage, and they're still married today.
So you really saw a well-functioning family and a successful marriage and and had positive feelings towards the institution of marriage.
Right, in contrast to my ex-husband, whose parents are married still today, but it's not a loving marriage, and they're basically married because of the religious strictures against divorce.
Right. So he grew up in a household of tension.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, you're a pretty good candidate then for probably having a successful new relationship.
Yeah, I don't think I have a problem with that. And I'm just asking the question because you made the blanket statement about if people come from a divorce.
No, I think you just have to look at it. It's the quality of the relationship and the quality of how people felt about their family. I mean, there have been some very successful divorces where people have really remained fairly civil and fairly good friends and keep seeing each other at different holidays or important events. So, I mean, you can have very positive civilized divorces and you can have very traumatic and destructive ones.
Well, even if there's a destructive and traumatic divorce and one of the parties comes from such a background, it still is possible to overcome that. I mean, people do survive that kind of adversity, and sometimes we don't even know why. It just may work out. But a long engagement would tell you or give you a pretty good idea if it would work out, even if there are some very ugly things in the background.
And you know, it's all about the middle path. So you do have this checklist of 35 items. But the truth of the matter is, if 50% of marriages end up in divorce, then, you know, there's about 50% of the population who's the child of divorce. And if you delete all of those people just based on that, without examining it more closely, then, you know, the pool gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So, you know, take everything on a case-by-case basis. Keep in the back of your head that divorce is a flag, so check out the flag and then figure out, you know, when it happened, before a certain age, after a certain age, rancor, no rancor, parents did it right, did it wrong. And then, you know, and then from there, again, you're doing your due diligence and you're going into it with useful information. All right, we have another question here. Thank you so much for that one, Jacqueline. And okay. And we have area code 909. Where is that? Is that like North Carolina or something?
No, it's Southern California.
Southern California, all right.
Inland Empire.
Oh, that's what it is. All right, well, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I just had a question. I wanted to know your opinion on long-distance relationships. You kept on mentioning the importance of long engagements, and I'm wondering if you think that two people who are in a long-term relationship but long distance in two separate cities would be able to learn enough about each other to decide whether they should marry.
Well, I think time together helps. So I think it depends upon the quality of time you spend together and what you do to learn to know each other. So it doesn't matter if one lives in New York and one lives in Los Angeles. If when you are together, you have ample opportunity to really explore each other.
And, you know,
separations are hard, but I think that it doesn't mean that they can't be a positive relationship.
Is this a long distance courtship you're talking about? I'm not quite clear on the question.
Yeah, we've been together for 4.5 years and have been long distance for 3.5 out of 4, but we see each other once a month on weekends and on school breaks. We're both earning graduate degrees, see each other for week, 2 weeks at a time, a month at a time during the summer.
Uh-huh. Well,
and we feel certain about each other, but, you know, there's always a question in my mind of, well, we've only really been together in the same city for 1 year, and how much can I really know?
I think it could work out very well. I think it's how you have explored each other when you're together, and how you handle separation, and you don't feel abandoned in the separation. So I think that you could very well move into a, you know, after your, when you are together, things are pretty positive.
Yes, yes, very positive.
Now, eventually, if you get married, are you going to live together, or is this separation
continue
after marriage?
Oh, no, we would not get married until we were able to live together.
Yeah.
But the question is whether we would be able, whether we know enough to make the decision to get married before we actually live in the same city again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what your responsibility would be, to kind of have enough experiences together to sort of feel comfortable about actually deciding to marry. But I was separated from my husband before we were married, because I still was in school when he was working in New York and so on. So, you know, and ours did last. It'll be 65 years in June.
So far, so good.
Congratulations. Thank you.
So far, so good. Yeah, and I'll chime in briefly. I think a big theme of this call is how to gather useful, accurate information, right? And the thing is, when you are together, do you think you are getting the information that is accurate and useful to kind of predicting how it's going to be later on? Because if you have these short interactions, well, it's going to be Christmas every time you meet. Nothing can possibly go wrong, right? But if you have a longer term relationship, if you're living in the same place for 2-3 months, then you get to see the day-to-day, and then you're getting some useful data about what the interaction, you know, that third element, you, him, and the bond, right? The bond is the element you want to look at, what that looks like.
And I think having a variety of experiences together, I think visiting each other's family, for example, going on camping trips or traveling together, or going to the beach or going to a mountain, going to each other's work parties. So you you sort of have a broad spectrum of experiences where you see each other interacting.
That is great
advice.
Thank
you.
That's brilliant. And I don't see any more questions up here. So if you have any, one last question, 5-star. Press 5-star on your handset, and we'll be able to get you here and answer your question. And if not, that is okay too. We've gone a little bit over time. It is now 7:10. Going once, going twice, and I think that's it. So, well, thank you again to Dr. Isabel Fox and Bob Fox for sharing with us your wisdom and your great book and the Prospective Spouse Checklist, available on Amazon right now. And, you know, I think $14.95 is quite a bargain for the wisdom that you're transmitting here. You can get it on your Kindle. You can get
Barnes & Noble. And I think it's even cheaper on Amazon. I think it's 11 something.
Oh, wow. Okay, there you go.
$66.
Yeah.
They ship it. So.
There you go. So definitely an essential part of your relationships library. And if people want to get a hold of you, Isabel, how would they go about doing that? Or to find out more about the book, where would you send them?
Well, we have a website of the Prospective Spouse Checklist. And also
the Prospective Spouse Checklist.com.
So all four words, the Prospective Spouse Checklist.com.
Or if you Google my name, Isabel Fox, PhD, there's a lot of stuff that comes up.
Isabelle Fox, Isabel Fox, PhD. Great. And if they have questions, where can they send them?
Write to me.
Well, you can send to our website, as mentioned, our email, but it's foxbethere@aol.com.
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 That is fantastic. So I'm going to open up the lines here. So we still have most of the people who dialed in on the call. So you've had them riveted, Isabel and Bob. So thank you so much for your very interesting book and the information you've imparted. So audience, this is your chance to say a big thank you to Isabel
and
Bob.
Conference unmuted.
Thank you.
So go ahead, everybody.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Thank you, Isabel and Bob. Thank you so much. And hey, everybody, this will be recorded, and I'll put the recording up on the blog. You can find it there. You can download it. You can share with your friends. You can tell your friends about it. Thank you so much for your attention. And this has been the Prospective Spouse Checklist Teleclass with Isabel Fox and Robert Fox. Thank you so much for your time and attention. Dr. Ali Benazir, and good night, everybody.